You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Perspectives on an Intellectual Career, first Q&A panel with Tara Smith, John Allison, Brad Thompson, and Matt Bateman. This lecture was recorded as part of Ayn Rand Conference Global's How to Put a Dent in the Universe, a conference examining an intellectual's role in society and how it can shape the world.
So now we've got about 15 minutes for questions. We've already got a number of questions coming in on the Q&A board. So if we can get all four of our panelists back, everybody, I see you all there now. Thank you for rejoining here. Now, this was a really interesting session. And I think what I was hoping for from the panel is what we've seen is just such a wide variety of career paths and possibilities, objectivism applied in business, objectivism applied in academia, and a lot of advice about what it looks like to embark on an intellectual career. So I think I want to start there with a question that came in Spanish, and you can interpret this however you will. So the question is, according to your experience, what's the first step to become a good intellectual? And I think you can think about where the starting point is. Imagine a high school student or a college student. You know, what's the very first thing they should do? And I guess I should. So whatever, everyone's not talking at once. Why don't we start with Tara? Or you could stick your hand up if you have something to say on that, and I can call on you. But Tara, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. So what's the first step in if you want to have an intellectual career? That's the question.
Well, Matt just put his hand up, so why don't you
tell? Well, no, I mean, I'll say this. First you want to make that decision. You want to be paying attention to evidence about yourself to make that kind of decision. And I do think, and here I do agree with some of what Matt was saying toward the very end, you can't always know in advance what you're going to love. So even as I was ending my talk saying, find what you love doing, I thought of maybe I should say, find what you really like doing. And you don't know until you're into a career a little bit or even into grad school a little bit, ooh, these aspects that I don't like, they loom larger or whatever. So you can't plan it all completely systematically in advance until you have certain firsthand experience. But I think one of the first things to do is, well, I guess twofold. Two of the first things to do. Really identify for yourself what in the actual activities that seem to be involved in having this kind of career, which of those do I really enjoy, think I could bring real value to, that I could, you know, that I'm pretty good at and am interested in getting better at. And I completely forget my second point. So there you go. Sorry.
Matt, did you have something to add on that?
I have a bunch of stray thoughts that kind of relate to taking a first step. So one is that the majority of intellectual careers, there's a question as to what it means to even have an intellectual career and how you're thinking about that, but just abstracting away from that. The majority of intellectual careers involve some sort of teaching or it's very common for it to, and there's a reason for that. It's because when you're kind of taking a humanistic perspective on a field or a topic, a big part of your value add is that you're providing clarity, and interacting with others in a direct way to help them gain clarity is one of the value adds that you can provide. It's not the only thing that you can do, but it's a common thing to do, and it's a common first step. Like when you're a grad student, you will be teaching, you'll be a TA, and this is why the university values you. And there are other avenues and channels for kind of speaking and teaching too. So I would just think about ways to start doing that, like ways that you can see, can I run seminars? Can I give little talks? Is there a context in high school where I can be responsible for a part of a class that I care about? Or can I start a reading group and lead a reading group where I'm a leader? So that's a very concrete thing. People often think of writing as an intellectual activity, and it is, but I think in some ways, teaching is a smoother ramp up. It's like a shallower ramp. Another thing is something that I wish I had done more, and that it's easier to do now than ever, is there's this thing that engineers talk about sometimes and you hear in Silicon Valley, which is you can now learn in public. I think learning kind of to learn to be an intellectual in public or to understand intellectual things in public is pretty coextensive with the process of kind of being an intellectual. So if you're on social media, on internet forums, on Twitter, on like there's kind of different things and you can do and people you can engage with and ways you can engage where you're like parsing your ideas in real time and trying to apply them and getting feedback and seeking feedback and sharing your writing, like starting a little blog and sharing it and getting feedback that way. Like, again, I mean, the internet was a very different place when I was in college. And you see people doing this even in software engineering and places like that. I think it's a good thing to do if you're trying to be an intellectual.
Those kinds of activities can seem daunting to young people. And we actually got questions that came in for Brad, two related ones. Can you share your experiences the first time you went in front of the class as a teacher? How confident were you? What did that feel like? Because you're suggesting, you know, just go out and do this sort of thing. But what does that actually feel like for the first time? And then another question that came in for you, Brad, was how do you talked about improving your writing ability. How do you do that? Is it just doing it every day and practicing or other things?
Yeah. So on the first question, my first real teaching experience, as I said, was teaching at this all boys boarding school. And I did not have an education degree. I had zero training. I'd never stood in front of a classroom teaching before. So when I walked into my first class ever, I had never taught before. And I went in, I tried to be as prepared as I possibly could. You know, it seemed to fit like a glove. I mean, and that was sort of the moment on that first day of teaching. I realized that, you know, I can do this, that I'm pretty good at it, and that I have a passion for it. And I did. And so, you know, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, like writing, you can teach yourself to be, a good teacher. If you don't naturally have, and I think teaching is an art, much less than a science. And there are those who can naturally walk into a classroom with very little training and they can teach pretty naturally. Others have to work at it pretty hard. And if you're somebody who has to work at it pretty hard, you have to, one, make sure that you know the subject better certainly than your students do or anybody else. And secondly, you know, you just have to, you know, I mean, teaching is about confidence, and confidence comes from knowing the subject better than your audience. So I think that was my experience. It was a very good experience. And then I'm sorry, the second question on writing. I think there are two things. You have to write as much as you can. As I said, I've been writing just about every day now for several decades. You have to just write, write, and write. The second thing I would say is learn from great stylists. Spend time, you know, reading Ayn Rand, reading other great writers, both fiction and nonfiction. Copy their style until eventually you can develop your own style. And then three, after I was told by that professor that I didn't know how to write, the first thing I did was I went out and bought Strunk and White's book on how to write. So I taught myself.
I'll take this opportunity to mention that the Objectivist Academic Center does have a writing component, and Ayn Rand has a lot to say about the methods of writing and principles of writing. She has a book called The Art of Nonfiction, which we use as a textbook in the OAC program. So there's a lot of writing instruction there. Tara, you wanted to add something.
If I could just add a couple of things. And I was going to mention, yes, The Art of Nonfiction is an excellent short book. It was based on some workshop type lectures she had with a few people, but I reread it periodically. About 2 weeks ago, I started rereading it again. And there's just a lot of good thinking advice in there. It's not only about, well, if you want to write nonfiction essays or something like that. So really, I would recommend it for anybody who wants to be a better thinker, okay? I agree with a lot of what Brad has said, that I think some people will kind of take to teaching naturally from the first time and feel like, oh, I think I could do that. You know, you feel effective, that's great. If you don't feel so effective, but if you're really interested in teaching, you'll be interested in figuring out Why didn't that go over as well as I anticipated? What was it in my explanation of Plato's theory of the cave that I wasn't making clear to them? So I think, and I think, Brad, this even came through in some of what you were saying earlier, you care about the teaching. You care about the students. And if you do, that means you care about them getting all that knowledge that you have. So I do think a lot of this has to do with theory of education. You know, I was talking about communicating is an important part of what we do. And obviously, Matt Bateman is, you know, philosophy of education. What do we have to think about there? And if I can also say a word about John Allison's career. He couldn't be that successful. I mean, he couldn't be that successful at this company unless he were a damn good communicator. He wasn't giving lectures all the time to people. That's exactly how you turn off the people who are your branch managers or your loan people, right? But A, he was out there at the branches visiting. No, I'm in South Carolina. This, he's going places, hearing what people have to say, trying to put it together and, you know, give people a way of fluidly incorporating the ideas, which is just, it's another really nice example of the philosophy in practice and suiting your audience in a certain sense, which is not to say that he was trying to preach to people, but anyway.
So that actually helps because we got questions for all of our speakers. And this is, there was a much more business related question for John, which you just gave me a good segue into bringing that one up. So this is for you, John. In terms of core values and training your employees on business philosophy, this is maybe a bit of a technical question, but do you have a view on the relationship between the leadership and the HR department and the role that they can play in helping with this process of training and spreading the corporate culture and that sort of thing?
Well, the leadership has to define what you really want to train people on. And then you have to find people in the HR department that can execute. As Tara said, our education, we had a university and we taught formal courses, how to be a teller, how to be a relationship banker, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of our education was having trained managers, and I think of myself in that regard, that could provide feedback almost on a daily basis, frequently. And that's not an HR function. So HR can take the systems that basically management has to tell them what those systems are, find people that can execute those kind of systems and put the mechanics together. But most of the training really is a leadership problem that happens every day, but certainly more often than in the formal training programs. And that's not really an HR function, that's really a management function. And I think that one of the weaknesses in many organizations is kind of the formalization of education versus the informal, let's do it now. Let's provide feedback today, this minute, on what's happening here, good or bad, good or bad. And I spend a lot of time just traveling around talking to people and giving them feedback and letting them give me feedback. We had breakfasts with all of our high-performing non-officer employees. I would go around throughout the Carolinas, Virginia, Georgia, Florida, wherever. And what I would find, if there was a theme or something was bothering our frontline employees, who are really the people that touch your clients on a daily basis, we needed to fix it. And I found that a lot of times the organization would be in resistance to fixing it, because somebody up the chain of command had some vest in how it was being done. And oftentimes I had to insist that something that seemed pretty obvious to me, when a lot of your customer service representatives tell you it's a problem, needs to be changed, it needed to be changed. And so a part of the leadership thing is also listening, and listening very carefully to what people's issues are and looking for common threads in those issues.
I think that's similar to the point that Brad made at the beginning of his talk about arguing with his professors. The first thing you need to do is listen to what they have to say and learn from them. We have so many questions and we're basically at time. So I think we're going to collect all these questions and we'll try to find some mechanism for, you know, maybe at the, we're having this OAC info session in a week. Maybe we can take up questions that we can answer during that session. Unfortunately, I wish we could go for another hour with this panel, but we have to pause here. So I want to thank all of our panelists for their presentations and for their questions, their answers to the questions.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.